Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today we're tackling abdominal and gastrointestinal emergencies, or GI emergencies, our mission. To pull out those key knowledge nuggets, the really critical stuff for managing these situations. You know, GI issues are super common, abdominal pain, nausea, things like that. But sometimes they escalate incredibly quickly. We're talking life-threatening problems, yeah. Potentially leading to systemic issues like, well, septicemia, if they're ignored.
That's right. And we're looking at this from the perspective of, you know, how professionals actually assess and manage these events. It's interesting because the digestive system itself is incredibly efficient.
Yeah, it really is.
But often it's patient behaviors or underlying conditions that kind of tip the scales towards these more dangerous outcomes.
Okay, so let's unpack that, starting with the anatomy. Maybe some surprising facts about that journey food takes. I read it can be anywhere from, what, 8 to 72 hours?
Yeah, it's a huge range. Digestion obviously starts right in the mouth, chewing, enzymes. Then the stomach takes over with acid and churning, creating chyme. But the really crucial part, and this is key for understanding emergencies, is that about 90% of all nutrient absorption, that happens in the small intestine.
90%, okay.
And then you have the liver. What a powerhouse.
It really is central, isn't it? Producing bile, detoxifying things, metabolism, even handling blood coagulation factors.
Yeah.
If the liver has problems, it seems like everything else can get backed up.
Exactly. That backup is directly linked to some of the really serious emergencies we'll get into. But before we jump into system failure, we should probably mention the appendix.
Yes, the appendix. For years, everyone thought it was just there, useless.
Right. Turns out it's actually got this important immune role. It's got lymphocytes, T cells, B cells, secretes immunoglobulin A, and it's like a little reservoir for good gut bacteria.
So it's not useless at all. It actually highlights how complex the system is.
It does. Which kind of brings us to when things go wrong. The sources really emphasize that most GI emergencies come from medical conditions, not so much trauma, inflammation, blockages, that sort of thing.
Which means that initial assessment is absolutely critical.
Absolutely. In that first look, the primary survey, you're looking for clues. How's the patient positioned? Any unusual smells? And if they're vomiting, aspiration is a huge immediate risk. You need suction ready.
Right. Airway first, then circulation.
Yep. Check the skin color, temp, moisture. Compare those central and peripheral pulses. But the real indicator for significant fluid loss or bleeding is checking orthostatic vital signs.
Explain that a bit. How does that work?
Okay, so you measure their blood pressure and pulse lying down, then have them stand up carefully. If they've lost a lot of volume internally, the body just can't compensate quickly enough when they stand. And a positive sign, meaning significant volume loss, is generally a drop of 20 points in the systolic BP, or maybe an increase of 10 in the diastolic, or the pulse rate jumping up by 20 beats per minute.
Okay, so that tells you right away, we need fluids now.
Exactly. Volume resuscitation becomes a priority.
And then there's pain. Lots of different types. But which one really signals danger?
Well, you have visceral pain, which is kind of dull and vague, but the one to really watch for is parietal pain. That often presents as rebound tenderness.
Rebound tenderness? That's when it hurts more when you let go after pushing.
Precisely. You press gently, then release quickly. If that release causes sharp pain, it means the peritoneum, the lining of the abdomen, is irritated. And that usually points to something serious, like a rupture or severe inflammation. Likely needs surgery.
Got it. And just looking at the abdomen, asymmetry.
Yeah, if it's not symmetrical, it could suggest a tumor, a hernia, maybe an enlarged organ, or even pregnancy. Then you palpate, you feel gently for any rigidity, unusual masses. Could be an enlarged liver, maybe even a pulsating mass, like an aortic aneurysm or just bowel distension.
Okay, let's shift focus to specific emergencies involving bleeding or rupture. GI bleeding itself is a symptom, right? How do you quickly figure out if it's upper or lower GI?
Usually by the stool. Upper GI bleeds because the blood gets digested on the way down, typically cause melena. That's that dark, tarry, really foul-smelling stool.
Right.
Lower GI bleeds, the blood is fresher, hasn't traveled as far, so you usually see hematochezia, bright red blood mixed in with the stool.
Makes sense. Now, esophageal issues linked to vomiting.
Yeah.
There's Mallory-Weiss syndrome, a tear causing bleeding.
Sure.
But you mentioned Borjeov's syndrome is much worse.
Oh, much worse. Mallory-Weiss is usually a tear just in the lining, the mucosa. Borjeov's syndrome is a tear that goes all the way through the wall of the esophagus. It's a longitudinal rupture.
A complete hole.
Yes. And during that forceful vomiting, suddenly you've got air, blood, stomach contents being forced into the mediastinum, the chest cavity. It's catastrophic.
Mortality must be high.
Extremely high, up to 90% if it's not treated right away. And the tricky part part is the main symptom is often severe upper chest pain, sometimes with very little initial bleeding. So it can look exactly like a heart attack, an MI.
Wow. So you have to have a high index of suspicion. Treat it like an MI until proven otherwise.
You really do. Then there are esophagogastric varices. This links back to what you said about the liver.
Right, the backup problem.
Exactly. If the liver is damaged, often from something like hepatitis C, blood can't flow through it easily via the portal vein. So it backs up into the veins around the esophagus and stomach.
Causing them to swell up like balloons.
Kind of, yeah. They become dilated, thin-walled varices, and under even slight pressure, they can just rupture.
Leading to
massive vomiting of bright red blood. Patients go into shock very, very quickly. It's a true hemorrhage emergency.
Okay, let's talk inflammation. Peptic ulcer disease, PUD, and gastritis, which is like the inflammation before the ulcer forms.
Mm.
There's a classic symptom pattern here, right?
Yes, absolutely. That burning, almost gnawing pain, usually in the upper abdomen. The key thing is it often feels better right after eating, but then comes back with a vengeance a few hours later when the stomach's empty again.
And causes are often H. pylori bacteria or maybe chronic NSAIDs use.
Yeah.
Like ibuprofen or naproxen.
Those are the big ones, yeah. Chronic NSAID use, H. pylori infection, or sometimes even severe stress or trauma can trigger it.
Okay, moving through other inflammatory issues, cholecystitis, gallbladder inflammation.
Right, often due to gallstones. And for risk factors, clinicians sometimes use the mnemonic, the 5 F's.
Which are?
Fair, meaning Caucasian, fat, female, fertile, and 40 to 50 years old. Obviously not exclusive, but those are common risk factors. The classic sign is sharp pain in the upper right abdomen, especially after eating a fatty meal.
Then appendicitis. Seems straightforward, but it can lead to sepsis pretty fast.
It can. Basically, a blockage, often fecal matter, builds up pressure inside the appendix. This cuts off blood flow, the tissue starts to die, and eventually it can rupture.
Spilling infection into the abdomen.
Exactly. Leads to peritonitis, and that can quickly become systemic sepsis.
And how does that differ from diverticulitis?
Diverticulitis involves small pouches, diverticula, that form in the colon wall, often linked to low-fiber diets. Feces get trapped in these pouches, causing inflammation or infection. The key difference in location is that diverticulitis pain is typically in the left lower abdomen.
Left lower for diverticulitis, right lower typically for appendicitis.
Got it. And what about obstructions?
Bowel obstructions mean things just can't move through. Could be paralysis of the bowel or something physically blocking it, like narrowing the diameter. Small bowel obstructions are often from adhesions, like scar tissue after surgery.
And large bowel.
Large bowel obstruction is very serious, often fatal if not treated promptly. And then, briefly, you have neoplastic conditions, like tumors. Pancreatic tumors, unfortunately, are known for being particularly aggressive and having a poor prognosis.
Which brings up an important point for professionals dealing with these end-stage conditions.
Right. The assessment has to go beyond just the physical findings. You need to check about advance directives. Is there a living will, a DNR order? Is hospice involved? It's part of comprehensive care in those situations. So pulling this together for the professional managing these crises, the basic goals are always ABCs, airway, breathing, circulation, manage the pain, nausea, vomiting, use standard precautions. But there are some critical, maybe counterintuitive guidelines.
Definitely. The absolute number one golden rule for almost any significant GI emergency, do not let the patient eat or drink anything. NPO, nothing by mouth. Essential to prevent aspiration and prepares them for possible surgery.
Okay, NPO. What about pain meds?
The philosophy is usually to make the patient comfortable, but not necessarily to completely eliminate the pain, especially before surgeons have made a definitive diagnosis. Pain can be an important diagnostic clue. So meds like fentanyl, morphine, sometimes ketorolac are used carefully.
Right. Now let's talk fluids again, especially with major bleeding like those ruptured varices. The source material stresses something really important about blood pressure goals. You don't want to normalize it.
Correct. This is absolutely crucial. It's called permissive hypotension. When someone's actively bleeding, you give fluids, usually an isotonic solution like saline or Ringer's lactate, but only enough to bring their systolic blood pressure up to about 90 to 100 millimeters of Hg, maybe slightly lower in some protocols.
Why keep it low? Why not aim for a normal 120?
If you push the pressure up too high too fast, you risk blowing off the fragile clot that the body is trying desperately to form at the bleeding site. That just restarts or worsens the hemorrhage.
Okay.
Plus, aggressively giving tons of fluid dilutes the blood they have, left fewer red cells, fewer platelets, fewer clotting factors. So you maintain just enough pressure for essential organ perfusion without making the bleeding worse.
So keep the pressure deliberately lowish, around 90 to 100 systolic. And only if you can't maintain even that, then you consider vasopressors like dopamine or norepinephrine.
That's the usual approach, yes. And remember, hypovolemia, that low volume state, isn't just from bleeding. Severe vomiting and diarrhea cause massive fluid loss too.
How does that work?
The body pulls water out of the cells and tissues, trying to keep enough fluid volume inside the blood vessels. This causes dehydration at the cellular level and serious electrolyte imbalances, on top of the overall low volume stressing the circulation.
Okay. We've covered a huge amount here, from common things like ulcers and gallbladder issues, right up to those terrifying ruptures like Borjoff syndrome, where you have to think like it's a heart attack.
Exactly. And the sources consistently circle back to prevention. Things like a high-fiber, low-fat diet, quitting smoking, managing alcohol intake, reducing stress, these lifestyle factors can significantly lower the risk or severity of many of these acute GI disasters. Your long-term habits really do set the stage.
That connection between lifestyle and these sudden acute crises is really striking.
It really is. So think about that common thread we saw: portal hypertension, the blood backup from liver issues causing varices. It's a kind of long-term pressure building up, leading to an acute failure. It makes you wonder, what hidden, maybe subtle backup pressures might you be creating in your own body through everyday habits or routines? Things that seem minor now, but could be silently increasing the risk for some kind of critical organ or vascular problem down the road. It's that link between the chronic and the acute that's really worth considering.